From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the legislative panel investigating Flint's water crisis wraps up hearings without hearing from Governor Snyder or the emergency managers. We've got the GOP take.
Moving towards the solution seems to be the next logical step to continue to help the citizens of Flint.
And the Democratic take.
Obviously, we missed an opportunity to make sure that we fully understood why things happened. If you don't know why, it's really hard to stop it from happening again.
Plus, Lansing City Council still trying to figure out why its former city attorney abruptly resigned with a generous payout.
And it's $250,000 of taxpayer dollars that were used for settlement, which was not city-related. It wasn't work-related.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are still unanswered questions and a growing pile of legal bills swirling around the resignation of Lansing's former city attorney. Janine McIntyre resigned March 4th, but was still paid $160,000 in salary and accrued benefits. And now legal costs related to the separation are mounting. Meantime, neither McIntyre nor Lansing Mayor Virge Bonaro will say why she left and why she got such a generous payout. The mayor's only comment was it may be, in his words, poor politics, but good business. Lansing City Council met last night, hoping to figure out who's being paid for what and why. Judy Brown Clark's the president of the Lansing City Council. Judy, what questions did you have going into last night's meeting?
We were trying to find out what the billing represented. And Mr. Gordon had the lead on negotiating the separation agreement and making sure that it complied with both our city charter and the executive management plan. And so we wanted to know exactly what his firm was hired to do.
And how much has the sticker price been for the work the firm did?
Well, what was interesting is when Mr. Gordon was speaking, I asked the question, had we received all the invoices related to the separation agreement, and he stated that he had just submitted one that day. And so I found it very ironic that the day that we would have him in was the day that he would actually be submitting bills. So, and it's not $160,000. It's $250,000 if you calculate all of her health care, her pension, all the pieces to it, and the legal bills. It comes up to close to $250,000.
I'm getting the sense you're still not sure who's doing what and why.
Yes, there seems to be a lot of attorney-client privilege, and it's interesting in the conversation. At one point, the city is known as both the administration, representing the mayor, and ourselves, city council, yet when it comes to attorney-client privilege, it keeps tilting to the side of administration, even though we're the one that confirms Ms. McIntyre, and she works directly for both the administration and the city council.
Did you get any kind of answers that were satisfactory last night?
I think we got some clarification as relates to that there's more bills than we anticipated. Really finding out, you know, what the impetus was that even had the separation agreement. We know that this was not grounded in employment. We know this was a separation agreement for the best interest of the city based on litigation. So we know it has nothing to do with her job or job performance. And the mayor stated that he was very pleased and she had served the city well. So we know that the separation agreement is grounded purely in getting in front of litigation.
Now, I'm wondering why no vote was taken last night on whether to hire outside legal counsel to help you look into this further.
What Mr. Boud, our interim city attorney, stated is that we as counsel cannot secure our own outside counsel. That can only be done through his law office. Where I've disagreed with that is that the reason that the administration secured outside counsel is because there was a direct conflict with the city attorney because it was about Ms. McIntyre. I still feel that Ms. McIntyre, who hired Mr. Abood, I feel that there's still a tremendous amount of conflict, and Mr. Abood has stated there's conflict, so I don't see where us asking him to secure outside counsel for us when he's already stated that he has a conflict. But supposedly his city attorney ruling was that we had no ability based on the charter to secure our own outside counsel and that that just kind of ended our ability to pass a vote for outside counsel.
Judy, you and I first talked about this kind of this mystery swirling around this sudden resignation of your city attorney, Jeanine McIntyre. Have you in that time been able to at all address concerns and questions to Mayor Virge Bonero?
No, everything is kind of going through the city attorney. Everyone is behind the cloak of either attorney-client privilege or disparaging clauses, which have a $10,000 fee associated with them. So it's right now we're kind of at a stonewall. What we did walk away with is looking at, instead of going for outside counsel, counsel has the ability to secure an investigator. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's something that I'll be looking into today and finding out if this will get us where we need to be, or do we just need to move forward with other options.
Where do you need to be? What does that mean? Where is it? Where do you want to go with this? Why are you pressing this?
Well, there's two things. Number one is $250,000 of taxpayer dollars that were used for settlement, which was not city-related. It wasn't work-related. There needs to be transparency, number one, with tax dollars, because that money could be used for a tremendous amount of other needs within the city. If there was something that was done that we are culpable for because there's pending litigation, I believe through transparency and good governance that we as the legislative branch would need to know that to make a determination of, you know, how that should be addressed.
And what are you and other council members hearing from people in Lansing? What are your constituents saying to you?
I mean, every time I walk out when I go to work, everyone is asking for clarification to find out, you know, fiscally, what was this money used for? Why was there a separation agreement? You know, what did the mayor do that there was a need for separation agreement? I am continuously asked these questions. A good portion of my colleagues have stated they've been asked these questions. We're receiving daily emails, either directly to us or to our city council email. So we're being barraged. We are being driven by not only our desire to do good governance, but the citizens of Lansing are asking us for transparency and resolution with this.
Judy Brown-Clark, president of the Lansing City Council. Judy, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And we reached out to Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero for an interview, as well as Lansing's interim city attorney, Joseph Aboud, and Dykema attorney, Gary Gordon, for statements. None of them responded to our request. Jeanine McIntyre's attorney, Jamie White, told us that his client is bound by a confidentiality agreement, so she is unable to provide any specifics related to her separation. Gender identity is something people are talking about more and more, and not just in Michigan and North Carolina. Across the pond, MPs in the UK recently said in a report that Britain has a long way to go before transgender people achieve equality. Among their recommendations, people should be able to declare which gender they are, regardless of what doctors or anyone else says. And it's the sort of thing already happening in the Republic of Ireland. Stateside's partner, the BBC's Keith Doyle, reports.
In the coffee shop of the Outhouse Centre in Dublin, Claire and Sam are checking out their picture in a magazine. This has been an extraordinary 12 months for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender, or LGBT, rights in Ireland. After being the first country in the world to pass marriage equality by public vote, its parliament introduced landmark legislation which allows people to legally decide their gender simply by filling out a form without medical or state interference.
I'm 71 years of age. I'm Claire Farrell. I've worked all my life as a male. So for me, the changes are huge. The state now has to accept me, and has to accept me as in the gender I have always wanted to be. It means that when I leave this world, I leave as Claire. And that, to me, is very important.
I was always acting the same way as I am now.
Sam Blankensee is a 22-year-old veterinary nursing student.
When I got the form, it was really like a big deal for me to see on paper that the government was recognising me as a guy. For a young person now to be able to show a birth cert that matches how they feel without having to talk about like the fact that they're trans, they can literally just show a piece of paper and not be asked all of the awkward questions I was asked.
It took legal challenges to the European Court of Human Rights to force the Irish government to draft new legislation. But once the process started, it went even further than many could have hoped for. Sarah Phillips is the chair of Transgender Equality Network Ireland.
Now, it's actually quite simple. You download an application form, you fill it out, post it away. Approximately 5-6 days later, you will receive your gender recognition certificate. There is a process then for if you wish to medically transition, you will go through that through the healthcare process. Because not every trans person will want to transition medically, and therefore they should not be denied then legal recognition.
Well, it's a cold and damp January afternoon on Dublin's Capel Street, outside one of the city's more popular gay bars. A stark contrast to the heat of last summer, when hundreds, if not thousands of people were out on this street celebrating the yes vote in the marriage equality referendum. And it was the overwhelming yes vote from the Irish electorate in that referendum that saw this latest legislation go through virtually unopposed.
I'm Kevin Humphreys, Minister of State at the Department of Social Protection. If you see where Ireland has moved since the 70s to where we are now in 2016, where we have probably one of the most progressive legislation, not only in marriage equality, but also in relation to our citizens that are transgender. When we started on this path, lots of that conservative opposition melted away when they heard the real stories on how it had impacted on them, how it impacted on their families, and how it had impacted on their children.
Despite the sea change, conservative voices do remain. Senator Jim Walsh was outspoken against same-sex marriage and has some advice for UK legislators.
They should look at the research, not totally accept in an uncritical way the advocacy of LGBT groups or of feminist groups who have a particular ideological agenda in many instances, because the legislation should reflect and respect the dignity of the individuals who find themselves in this particular situation, but should also balance that against the common good of society.
But the advice from Sam back at the Outhouse Cafe is for the government to embrace the MP's recommendations and even go further.
We've come so far. It's great to now see that the UK has kind of taken note and kind of are looking to use that to shape new and better legislation.
That's Sam ending the report by the BBC's Keith Doyle. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The question of just what bathrooms transgender people can use has become a very hot-button issue here in Michigan and all across the country. North Carolina and the Justice Department are suing each other over that state's controversial new law that, among other things, bans transgender people from using the bathroom of their choice. Attorney General Loretta Lynch condemned that law as state-sponsored discrimination with echoes of Jim Crow. Here in Michigan, public comments are still pouring in on this final day of the Board of Education's draft of voluntary guidelines for schools to respond to the needs of their LGBTQ students. And you guessed it, the bathroom question is fueling heated comments. What is really behind this bathroom panic? Allison Gash is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Oregon. Her recent piece on theconversation.com is titled, "What's the Backlash Against Gender-Neutral Bathrooms All About?" Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Why is it that bathroom safety is so essential for transgender people?
Statistically speaking, when you look at the troubles that transgender individuals face when they are not permitted to use the bathroom that matches their identified gender, we see increased rates of depression, increased rates of, you know, drug abuse that accompanies that depression, increased rates of suicidality. We also have physical tolls, so increased urinary tract infections, kidney infections, right, all the things that are associated with folks having to wait to use a bathroom that they feel safe in. In addition to the toll that it takes on an individual being deprived of their ability to express themselves in a way that matches their identified gender, there's also the physical and verbal abuse that they are subjected to in the context of bathroom choice. Folks are often subjected to verbally harassing threats. They are subjected to physically harassing threats that make it impossible for them to feel safe when they're trying to use a bathroom. in particular students, which is the focus of that article, what students will do on college campuses is they'll wait. They'll wait and they'll go home to use a bathroom, or they'll adjust their schedule so that they have bathroom breaks that are long enough to allow for them to go to a bathroom that they know to be safe and then not have to miss any class time. In the context of secondary schools, high schools, elementary schools, you have kids who end up missing tons of school because they simply don't feel safe using a bathroom at their school.
As you ask in your piece for theconversation.com, what is this backlash all about?
Well, you know, in some ways, this is a continuation of the backlash that LGBTQ folks have long endured. On some level, backlash to the idea of LGBTQ interests isn't new. I mean, certainly this is what accompanied the marriage debate. It's what's accompanied the employment debate for many, many, many decades. It's what accompanies housing discrimination and various sorts of interests that LGBTQ folks are fighting for. In that regard, it's nothing new. One of the things I suspect is going on is that as soon as you sort of close the door on one type of discrimination, the Supreme Court closed the door on discrimination in the context of marriage, that backlash and that opposition gets funneled into a different arena. And right now that arena is in the context of reactions to bathroom policies that permit transgender folks to use the bathroom of their choice. But these bathroom bills aren't just bathroom bills. These bathroom bills are actually tapping into a whole set of areas where states and localities are instituting bans against LGBTQ rights. This isn't just against transgender individuals, although transgender individuals are feeling the brunt of this. This is against a whole range of LGBTQ interests and also a whole range of civil rights interests in the context of the North Carolina bill. There's even, you know, race and gender stuff there as well.
Yeah, certainly it struck me that we wouldn't be talking so much about bathrooms if we had not had the DeBoer decision legalizing same-sex marriage.
You know, I think to a degree what that decision does is that decision says the gay community is here, transgender folks are here, right? We've been ensnared in this battle with conservatives for decades now, and we came out on top. And public opinion seemed, at least in some states, to have followed along with what the court's edict was. And so I think folks saw there was room to make increasing demands, you know. But then you also have the really brave stands that transgender students in particular took in this moment where we see progress on one level in the context of marriage. We're going to hope that the public stands up with us. And in a lot of contexts, that's been at a pretty serious risk to their own safety. A lot of this progress comes because of their courage and their bravery.
Allison, there's so much talk among critics, certainly when you go on and read the comments on the Michigan Board of Education's voluntary guidelines, that draft. There's so much talk about protecting our daughters and not having men in the women's bathrooms. And you argue in your piece for The Conversation that these bills restricting bathrooms, they're using feminism like a political football. How so?
This is what really gets me. This is what really makes me angry. First of all, when you read the bill, there's nothing in the bill about protecting women's rights. Nothing. Zero. If this were a bill about protecting women's rights, you would actually see something in there that mentioned some ability to curtail high rates of assault, high rates of battery, high rates of rape, high rates of all sorts of stuff women and girls have to deal with on a daily basis, and there's nothing in that bill to deal with that. Furthermore, the measures in this bill, in the North Carolina bill in particular, but in other bills, like the Mississippi bill that just passed and the Georgia bill that was ultimately vetoed and the Texas bill that's being considered and Michigan's bill as well, these things are broader. In North Carolina's circumstances, for instance, on what level does preventing gays and lesbians and transgendered individuals from lobbying for protections against employment discrimination, how does that help women? In what context does employment discrimination against gay folks help women? There's absolutely no connection between those two things. It's strategically really effective because it presents this sort of boogie monster in the same way that was presented in the context of marriage debates. It was effective in Houston, for instance, when voters outlawed an ordinance that would have done primarily the same thing that the Charlotte ordinance would have done, which is to protect bathroom choice. So they marshaled out this idea that women were going to be endangered by this bill, but there's nothing in these bills that protect women. There's real problems that women face and real dangers and real vulnerabilities every day at the workplace, at school, and there's nothing that these state legislators are doing to actually protect women. So I think it's pretty insulting. Furthermore, what a lot of these advocates are suggesting is that you have single-stall bathrooms, right? So single-stall bathrooms with a lock, which actually would help protect women. If you have single-stall bathrooms with a lock that are gender neutral, anybody using that facility would be safe. The transgender individual, the mom who's using it with their child, or the woman who has concerns about any sort of privacy and safety issues. That is a logical conclusion, a logical resolution to all of these problems, and yet instead we're just adopting bigoted and hateful legislation that does nothing, right, to actually prevent any bad things from happening.
Where do you see this bathroom panic headed, Allison?
After the North Carolina backlash came out, you know, I thought, well, maybe this will be, you know, just another sort of momentary fires creeping up in different states, but they'll be extinguished rather quickly. But Mississippi's religion bill is really concerning. This is a bill that just recently was passed, which basically allows Mississippians to use religion to do all sorts of stuff. You can use religion to deny employment. You can use religion to deny bathroom choice. You can use religion to deny housing. It's really broad, and they expect that the effects of that bill will actually be even broader than the original effects of the North Carolina bill. Where in other states, things like that had been vetoed, so in Georgia, a bill like that had been vetoed, we're still seeing Republicans using their legislative muscle, and they have a lot of state legislative muscle. This is something that folks don't realize. Republicans have done a great job of commanding a state legislative presence, and they're beginning to flex their muscles in this capacity. Texas is gearing up again for another fight, using the remaining, I think, 9 months of their session to bring about a similar bill to the one that was in North Carolina. You know, so it seems to me that even though that there's a sizable backlash, like the one we saw in North Carolina, there's still clearly enough support in the Republican base to warrant these kinds of assaults on the LGBTQ community and transgendered individuals in particular. Also, these bills are taking pot shots at all sorts of groups. So North Carolina's bill actually includes language that makes it really difficult for anybody who is discriminated against in the context of employment to make a claim in state court. And this is something that very few people are talking about. But all sorts of civil rights are being curtailed and affected by this Republican strategy.
Allison Gash is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Oregon. You'll find her piece, What's the Backlash Against Gender-Neutral Bathrooms All About, at theconversation.com. It was great to talk with you, Allison. Thank you so very much.
Absolutely. It was great.
A chapbook lets the poet focus like a laser on a single theme, a single topic. Michigan poet Kelly Forden is out with her new chapbook, The Witness. And the topic she explores is red hot. It's emotionally charged. The survivors of sexual abuse committed by priests. Kelly Forden, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you grew up Catholic. You were even an altar girl?
I was, yes.
That was something I wanted to do, but they weren't letting girls be altar girls at the time. So you know whereof you speak as far as the tradition you grew up in.
Yes, I was. I think I was one of the first group of altar girls at my – I know I was the first group at my church, and maybe in the whole church in the 70s. And I loved it. And often, you know, during the week, on the weekends, I did as many shifts as I could.
So that you loved – and the ritual and the traditions of the church. So what has led to this, to the poems in The Witness, and to wading head into this issue of clerical sexual abuse?
It is probably the last thing that I would have consciously wanted to do. My aunt took a boy to a retreat in 1985, and he was abused on the retreat by a priest. And she had no idea that that had happened at the time. It wasn't till 20 years later that she found out about it. And that was bad enough. You know, the boy, he didn't come forward. It was actually victims after him that came forward, and then finally he came forward as well. But that really hit home for me. I mean, it was my aunt in my family. She was very, very upset about it. She had been the chaperone. And then to find out that that priest had gone on for 20 years and gone to Ohio and gone to Rhode Island and gone to Peru, and he was a Dominican, and the Dominicans simply didn't believe people. Over and over again, people testified and wrote to them, and they just didn't believe it. So I was heartbroken about that. The thing that bothers me the most is the culture of, you know, deference to priests and deference to the clergy and not wanting to say anything. I mean, even you can hear in my voice how emotional this is for me to say anything against the Catholic Church, because my whole life, that's all I've known. But at the same time, I feel like so many people are protecting these priests. I mean, it is a very small percentage of priests, but people are obviously protecting them, moving them, shuffling them around. You know, there are a substantial number living in the Vatican now being taken care of. And it's just not right, in my opinion.
And you went through thousands of pages of testimony from at SNAP, which is Survivors Network of those abused by priests.
Correct.
And out of that came these poems?
I went through those, and I also went to the Center for Constitutional Rights. And they have asked the Vatican to release the testimony or release all of their documentation of sexual abuse, and the Vatican has refused. And so it's still up to victims to come forward, whereas, yeah, and you mm-hmm. know how difficult that is to speak up.
As you were crafting poems that, in essence, are presenting the stories of others, what was the challenge there? What did you want to say on their behalf?
Well, I did a lot of the poems in the voice of the witness, which is a person who has never been able to get over something, so is sort of stuck in a child mentality and has witnessed some of the abuse, whether they've experienced it themselves or witnessed someone else's abuse.
Kelly Forden is my guest. Her new chapbook of poems is The Witness, inspired by thousands and thousands of pages of testimony from people who were sexually abused by priests. David Klossy, the head of SNAP, was on this program a short time ago, Kelly, and this is what he had to say about the Vatican's response to sexual abuse by its clergy. Let's take a listen.
There has never been a Catholic bishop on the planet who has been defrocked, demoted, or disciplined for concealing abuse, shuffling predators, stiff-arming police, or any kind of misbehavior related to child sex crimes. You know, forget about all the policies and procedures and protocols and panels. You know, if Pope Francis would simply say, today, these 10 or 12 or 15 bishops are no longer bishops. They're just priests. Or we're kicking them out of the church because they knowingly moved predators and enabled kids to be hurt again. That would just send shockwaves throughout the Catholic world, and it should.
Do you think poetry could be a force for that kind of action on behalf of the victims?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think when you get into the statistics and, you know, I've gotten into this argument with people, you know, and they'll say, oh, it was a very small percentage of priests and blah, blah, blah. And it's easy for people to write that off and to argue against that. But when you get into the voice of someone who's actually experienced abuse, it's really hard to minimize that. Really, if you read the testimony as well, it's hard to minimize it once you've read it.
Well, in fact, speaking of the voice of the victim, I'm wondering if you'll give us the poem called The Witness 2.
Sure. The Witness 2. Most days he doesn't feel like saying anything antagonistic. Most days he's happy with toast and tea, a little bit of television, a stroll. But every now and then the witness is struck down mid-jaunt. Every now and then the witness tumbles down the stairs. The water in the shower comes out scalding hot. The witness's hair falls out in clumps. The witness can't remember his name. He can't even get out of bed. Shake it off. There is nothing he would like more. If you run into the witness at a dinner party, he will not bring it up. He'll listen to your suburban saga politely. He's been known to suck down a shot of vodka, a snort or two. In other words, he could be you if you had witnessed it. If you were on your merry way one day when you were very small and everyone around you was very, very tall, the witness cannot talk about this like a normal person, which is why they sometimes lock him up. They keep him under observation, like a faucet that's lost a clot. He can't seem to make the images stop.
And that's quite a life that these witnesses are living. Have you turned away from the Catholic Church?
Yes. I have. I really regret having to say that. As I said, one day it just snapped and I could not take it anymore.
Would there be any merit in speaking out for those survivors and against predator priests from within the church, or do you feel it can be more effective from the outside?
If there was any way for me to get my faith back in the Catholic Church, I would certainly work hard to do that. But once it was gone, it was just gone. Unfortunately, my thing is, so many people protected these priests and moved them from place to place. In fact, the metaphor I would use for it is it would be as if I was on the Titanic and I was riding along, and then the Titanic started to go down, and the architect, instead of going down with it and taking responsibility, jumped off and said, I have another one of these boats. Would you like to get on this one? And, you know, no, thank you. I need you to change the boat. I need you to, this is not structurally sound. This is not okay. And I just feel like they've danced around it too much. And if one day I were to see, you know, Pope Francis stand up and say, no, these bishops were wrong. These people protected pedophiles for no apparent reason. Here are all the documents. I'd come back.
Kelly Forden. Her new chapbook is The Witness. Kelly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how much should the presence of Zika and other mosquito-borne diseases impact our travel plans? A little? A lot? Not at all? Plus, the legislative panel investigating Flint's water crisis wound up hearings today. We'll ask why Governor Snyder and former emergency managers were never called to testify. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, the state began diagnostic testing for three viral diseases, Zika, dengue, and chikungunya, all carried by mosquitoes. Dr. Eden Wells is here with us. She's chief medical executive for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Well, we've certainly had no shortage of news stories about Zika, and it's pretty safe to say the prospect of having a baby born with microcephaly certainly caught everyone's attention. But Dr. Wells, tell us a little more about dengue and chikungunya.
You know, this is a mosquito-borne, both of them are mosquito-borne diseases, along with dengue, all carried by the Aedes mosquito. That's a type of mosquito that unfortunately loves to bite people during the day. This has been causing a number of outbreaks in South and Central America and in the Caribbean throughout the last 6 to 9 months. And with Zika, normally the symptoms, if you get it, it's not life-threatening. The symptoms usually are mild and have a rash. Chikungunya actually feels a lot worse. Again, it's not life-threatening, but people tend to feel a lot more horrible with a lot of severe bony and muscle aches. But both of these can be carried by the same strain of mosquitoes, as with a dengue, which actually can be very serious. And what we've been finding, though, is the Zika that has the serious complications in women who are pregnant because their fetuses may become malformed if they are infected with the virus.
So this week, the department's labs are beginning diagnostic testing. So what does that mean? Why is this?
Well, you know, what we want to do is we know that we are low risk here in Michigan for this particular mosquito transmission of either Zika, dengue, or chikungunya, because the mosquito, that Aedes mosquitoes, is not prevalent here in this state. Now, we do have Aedes aegypti, which is the real specific strain that has been known to carry all these diseases, that covers about the southern tier of the states, the United States. And a similar strain of Aedes actually comes about as far north as Ohio, but none here in Michigan. However, people who travel to areas such as South or Central America, have had a recent travel or developed symptoms in these areas, could conceivably become ill, and therefore, when they return, if they're ill, we would like to test them.
So this is less about the risk of somebody sitting out in their backyard and being bitten by an infected mosquito here in Michigan, and more about where'd you travel and might you have been bitten there?
Absolutely. We are very interested in making sure that healthcare providers and all of our Michigan citizens understand that for us here in Michigan, it's a travel-related situation for these three types of diseases, and that we are going to be very interested in making sure that a history is obtained if anybody who comes back or has lived or traveled in these affected countries in the South and Central America.
Dr. Wells, how many travel-related cases of Zika have we seen in Michigan, and have we seen any in pregnant women?
is there's been 3 travel-related cases reported in Michigan just in the last several months, and thank goodness, but none have been in pregnant women to date, which is really reassuring.
Now, the National Governors Association just urged the White House and Congress for very speedy action on funding to prepare for and fight the Zika virus. And that governor's statement reads, I'll quote here, "The nation is on the threshold of a public health emergency as it faces the likely spread of the Zika virus." So that just leads to the question, does Michigan have the resources and funding that you think we should have?
You know, I would say that right now we are all looking towards Congress for some supplemental Zika funding that would help all of the United States and territories prepare. We are not what we would consider a high-risk state, as I've mentioned, but we do want to be able, and we are planning on conducting mosquito surveillance because we want to make sure that these 80 mosquitoes that have been associated with Zika or dengue or chikungunya do not come and enter the state of Michigan. So that requires funding and a lot of resources to do. And while we are prepared to carry through our plan, certainly this federal funding will assist us in doing so.
I think for most of us, it's pretty confusing and alarming because it'll drill down here on Zika. Here is a word and a disease that I dare say most of us had never heard of up until a few months ago, and now it's a constant presence. What's your approach to saying, here's the real deal for Michigan?
I would say our risk is low, and I'd be more interested in, if it were me, where I travel. Am I traveling to an affected country, and am I at risk? And so this is really an issue for a childbearing aged woman, so a woman of childbearing age who is pregnant or planning on being pregnant, who is traveling or living in an affected country at this time.
And I guess that leads to where would you think, if you were a childbearing, if you were concerned with that possibility of being pregnant, where would you think twice about traveling?
You know, at this point, I would say that we're looking at areas in South and Central America and certain areas of the Caribbean. So certainly we've been, you know, Brazil was the most highly affected. There is a wonderful map on the CDC site which shows everywhere from Mexico all the way down through Paraguay and then most of the Caribbean islands off of Belize and Honduras. So any of these areas would be areas that I'd be concerned about. And I would add something else that is very interesting about this disease, that we now know that men who are from or have traveled to these countries and come back into the United States may be able to sexually transmit the disease, if they've become ill, to a woman who is planning on being pregnant or is already pregnant. So that's a whole issue here that we also need to be fully aware of.
Dr. Eden Wells, the Chief Medical Executive for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Wells, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
The chair of the Joint Legislative Committee looking into the Flint water crisis says hearings have wrapped up. Midland Republican Senator Jim Stamos was appointed chairman when the committee was created late last February. At the time, he promised to take testimony on the mistakes that led to the Flint water disaster at all levels of government and to explore potential ways to keep something like this from happening again in our state. Senator Jim Stamos is with us now. And Senator, here's the question. Why have hearings wrapped up and neither Governor Snyder nor any of Flint's emergency managers ever called to testify?
Sure. And what we did today in committee was to adopt all of the testimony that was given to our U.S. Congress. And Governor Snyder was one of those, along with some of the emergency managers that have given sworn testimony to the governor. And so what we did was incorporate those into the official record of the committee to continue to make sure that, as you said in your introduction, the citizens of Flint have been waiting for a long time for solutions. We've now had 61 hours of testimony along with 61 individual testimonies in 6 different hearings. And so what we want to do is continue to make sure, as we started out saying, solutions are the priorities. So moving towards the solution seems to be the next logical step to continue to help the citizens of Flint and start to prepare for the infrastructure across the state.
Well, Senator, didn't you or the members of the Joint Committee have any questions of your own that you would want to address on behalf of the people of Michigan?
We've had, again, 61 hours of testimony and had opportunities to have discussions with those that have testified on a variety of issues. So a lot of our members have had the opportunity, along with the information that we've received from multiple investigations. And so, as I believe Senator Anik had mentioned in one of the hearings, we didn't need to duplicate the process. We need to ensure that we find solutions.
Why not at least put the request out to the governor or any of the EMs so that at least if they don't testify, it's on them and not on the panel?
Sure. And it certainly seems as if the governor has given testimony before the U.S. Congress under sworn testimony. And I appreciate your question, but I think what we want to do is provide long-term solutions. And getting solutions started for the residents of Flint is where we wanted to set our priority.
Well, thinking of the residents of Flint and others in Michigan who were watching this happen, and again, I still think people are searching for what happened, why did this happen, and how can we keep it from happening, and that the governor and the emergency managers are such key players. I guess I'm wondering, why would anyone in Flint believe that this really was an effort to find out what happened without you addressing the governor and the EMs directly?
Well, Sydney, I appreciate your question. I think that we've addressed that. And again, this committee was put together to look for solutions, not to be an investigative. There's still multiple investigations going on. As they move forward, we as a committee have the opportunity, if we find additional information that we need, to look at that.
How would you respond to critics who say the optics appear that, you know, you're trying to protect the Republican governor?
Actually, I think that the committee did a very nice job on a bipartisan fashion at looking for the resident solution, not looking for the political solutions or the media solutions as they try to continue to look at the issues. And so what we've done is stayed focused on the issues before us, the Flint residents and the citizens of Michigan with infrastructure, and that is finding solutions.
Now what comes next, Senator?
We hope within the month to actually put forward hopefully a bipartisan recommendations to include legislation, but also recommendations both to the governor and to the locals of solutions to move our state and residents forward.
So are you satisfied with what has been done, and do you feel that the people of Michigan will be able to take something substantial away from the work that the committee's done?
Yes, I think that we've had an opportunity, but the committee's not done. We are looking to make those recommendations. We're looking to move forward legislation. But quite honestly, the long-term solutions for this, all of the residents in the state that have infrastructure is something that this legislature and future legislatures really need to start focusing on, and we hope with our recommendations we start to direct that focus there.
Midland Republican Senator Jim Stamos. Senator, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Over now to Flint Democratic Senator Jim Ananick, who was a member of the Joint Committee. Senator Ananick, we just heard Senator Stamos refer to you and that you said we didn't need to duplicate the process. We need to find solutions. So were you on board with not calling the governor or the EMs and relying on testimony given elsewhere?
You know, I didn't think that was the best way to go. I do have to say I appreciate all of my colleagues, both House and Senate, Republican, Democrat, for willingness to serve on this committee and to try to dig into these issues. And, you know, in some areas we did a pretty good job, but in other areas I think it's just important. I mean, oversight, by its very definition, means you have to dig deep into these departments and to make sure that you're holding the administration accountable. It doesn't mean that you're going in with some sort of preconceived notion that they did something wrong or did something right, but oversight, by its nature, helps make everyone more accountable, makes decisions better, and I think we missed the boat a little bit on that, but, you know, I'm hopeful that we can come up with some solutions for the short term and for the long term, for my community, of course, in Flint, but also for everyone else in the state.
As Senator Stamos said, you know, we're relying on the testimony that was given elsewhere. Weren't there questions you wanted to ask?
Yeah, there's no question about it. And we asked a number of questions in writing, and quite often, many times, we weren't given those responses back. And also, to me, you know, sort of abdicating our responsibility to the federal government, hoping the federal government does our job for us, seems a little bit short-sighted. And I mean, if anybody's watching the federal government, they're not doing a lot of good stuff right now. So, you know, I think it's a lot more important for us to hold our own departments accountable. You know, it's basically agreed upon that this was a state failing, whether through the emergency manager, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Health and Human Services, Treasury, the governor's office. You know, there was a number of departments to point blame at, but it was the state government that failed. So I think it's our responsibility to make sure we hold accountable and then we make policy solutions that can help solve the problem going forward. And I think we missed an opportunity there, but I think we can make it work as long as we're serious about the solutions.
When you say we missed an opportunity, what's your take? Why do you think the governor or any of the former EMs didn't get called to testify before your panel, particularly considering the governor's own task force really put the ultimate responsibility on the governor and his team?
And also, I mean, the governor's own task force said, we covered a lot of areas, and they did a really good job, but they even said it's the legislature's job to kind of go from here. And I think we, for whatever reason, I don't know exactly. I don't know what the rationale was, but when it comes to making sure that it never happens again, either in Flint or anywhere else, obviously we missed an opportunity to make sure that we fully understood why things happened. Because if you don't know why, it's really hard to stop it from happening again.
I'm kind of curious if you and Senator Jeff Irwin of Ann Arbor, as the two Democrats on this six-member joint committee, did you talk to the four Republicans about the optics of not calling on the governor?
You know, I mean, I didn't use terms like that. I mean, that's something I think that people will look at and say, you know, this seems kind of unusual that you wouldn't call the governor, who's obviously said over and over again he would cooperate with any investigation. So he was clearly eager to come before our committee and be under oath and talk about things. And for whatever reason, they chose not to. You know, I outlined to them a pretty detailed list of who I thought should come, when they should come, what the topic should be, you know, kind of documents we could get. You know, in federal government, they have executive session. So folks that are under court proceedings, they can have their attorney come in and meet with our attorneys, and we could review the documents and not make them public. I mean, there's all sorts of things we could have done to really get to the bottom of this. And I'm still going to take them at their word that they plan on providing policy solutions for the future. To me, that means nothing's off the table. And it's been almost everyone to a person has said that the emergency manager law and the emergency managers failed Flint, and the same emergency manager had failed the Detroit schools. It's pretty clear that we have to do something about that at the very least. And if we don't, then I don't think we're very serious about the solutions.
I kind of feel that people listening are going to be going, okay, Senator Ananick, tell me, seriously, did you not look them in the eye and go, why aren't we calling them? I mean, discussion happen?
No, yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't use terms like optics. I just said, you mean, of course we should call the emergency managers. Of course we should call the governor. Of course, we had Mission Flint, whose job it is sort of the recovery of what's happening. And obviously, you know, you've talked to me and other folks. I mean, the recovery is very slow.
Sure.
And not much is happening. The very people that are part of that, none of them that were in state government and were involved came before us to testify. You know, it was like, I mean, it's as if we went to every single link we could have to make sure that the only people that testify were the people the farthest away from the problem. And that just didn't make a lot of sense to me. So, by nature, I'm not I may be angrier inside than I am coming across on this interview. It's just for me, I still have to have safe water and the solutions to my community, and I'm just going to stay laser focused on that. I mean, I think we missed an opportunity, and I think it's unfortunate, but I'm in the minority. I can only control so much. So, you know, I'm going to keep focusing on, you know, trying to make changes, if not repealing the EM law, you know, holding these departments accountable through oversight and oversight commissions and things of that nature, and then make sure the citizens of Flint get the resources they need. But, you know, I may seem calm, but I'm not pleased with the way it went.
Flint Democratic Senator Jim Ananick, a member of the Joint Legislative Committee, which wrapped up its probe of the Flint water crisis without hearing testimony from either the governor or Flint's former emergency managers. Senator, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I am sure hoping you will be able to join me as Stateside hits the road this week. We'll do the show this Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m.
at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. Easy to get to, just off I-75 and I-94, a couple blocks from Woodward near the DIA. Absolutely beautiful. We'll have a lot of good conversation, live jazz from the Marcus Elliott Quartet. It's free, and we're looking forward to meeting you this Thursday, 3 to 4, Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. Details at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.